Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 28th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. This morning we had a discussion with Lyndon LaRouche in which he defined for us an immediate and urgent mission. We have to get a crash program for thermonuclear fusion going immediately, with an emphasis on transforming the part of the world from the west bank of the Mississippi River across the western states, up through North America, Canada, Alaska, through the Bering Strait, and down into Siberia, Asia, and at the same time going north into the Arctic. And the emphasis in his discussion, or the immediate urgency, I should say, is that we are talking about a part of the United States which is parched, which has no water, and in which food production has collapsed. But we're also talking about an ongoing 40 to 50 year problem of a collapse of industrial production in the United States and a loss of the capability not just to produce food, but to transport it and to develop the necessities for human life. And this is obviously an urgent question, because if you don't have food, if you don't have power, and let's just throw in the other big one, if you've got asteroids out there looking to kill you and you have no defense against them, then you're not going to have much chance for civilization to make it. Now, this is an immediate question for mankind. We have momentarily, it appears, escaped the danger of war, but we still have Obama in the White House, and we still have, even though the Queen is sick and Prince Philip is as crazy as ever, we still have a British Empire that's directing these policies of anti-growth, anti-technology, anti-science. Now, a major contribution towards this process of defining the mission for the country came out this last, about 2 weeks ago. The program from 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, Nuclear Nawapa 21, Gateway to the Fusion Economy. And if you don't have this report yet, get it and get extra copies of it. We're going to be discussing it today with two of the principal authors, Jason Ross, who is the editor emeritus, I'm told, of 21st Century Science and Technology, maybe not emeritus, and one of the researchers from the basement team who's done a lot of work on the question of NAWAPA and thermonuclear fusion, Ben Denniston. So Ben and Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Hi, Harley.
Good to be with you. I don't often have a chance to be in the studio and actually have this kind of interaction. Look, I'd like to just start with what Lynn was saying today, because we've had this seeming paradox that we've always been a few years away, maybe 10 years, 20 years away from having fusion. And one of the problems you get when you talk to people in the field is that they say, well, we're still 20 years away, we're still 30 years away. And of course, if you don't have a program for it, and you can't just have a small program, you've got to have a big program. So I'd like to start with that to hear from both of you. I'll start with you, Jason. How do you see this question of what's the immediate necessity if we're going to get a thermonuclear fusion program that's going to work and get us out of this crisis?
Well, the necessity is on many levels. I mean, you brought up one of the largest necessities eventually, which is the need to prevent an asteroid from striking us. But look at the economic situation and look at the strategic situation. The economy is terrible. It's collapsing. It's getting continually worse in the transatlantic sector. If we're going to turn that around, we need to make not a change in the way the economy is functioning, but return to actually having economic growth. Right now, we don't have any economic growth at all because we're not developing in a way that would cause any of it. Our species, unlike the animals, we change as if evolutionarily, not by growing more ribs or wings or anything like that, but by changing the kinds of fire, you could say, that we use. And we've seen this over the history of our species. The change from, in the long term, wood to coal to oil to what should have been a nuclear economy and what could now have become not just a nuclear fission economy, but a fusion economy. These are the platforms that we base ourselves upon in the realm of power. They represent an entire set of knowledge that we have about the world around us that then determines what we're able to do economically, how we're able to live, what kind of economy we have, what's a resource versus what's junk.
And we actually were on a course in the early 60s toward accomplishing this. There was a real intent to develop fusion and along with the idea of expanding the space program.
Yes, I mean, think about the world's introduction to nuclear power, for example. What was the world's introduction to the power of the nucleus? It was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think about the fact that Japan actually ended up becoming a nation with a great deal of nuclear power relative to its total power consumption. So you had in the 50s, you know, under Eisenhower, the Atoms for Peace proposal, and moving into the Kennedy era, of saying, how are we going to use this new, entirely new domain of physical principles for the benefit of mankind? And we were moving in that direction. Really, at the late 60s, early 70s, you had the environmentalist movement, so-called, really take off and then demand the sacrifice of nuclear as one of their major objectives.
And Ben, you pointed out one of the very compelling charts in this report on the power per capita and the trend lines and where we were going by the decade from 1780 to the present. Why don't you describe that and what the implications of this chart is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this goes directly to Mr. LaRouche's idea of economics, which goes to what makes mankind fundamentally different than an animal, and how do you measure that process. And so he's got this understanding of energy flux density. And hey, it's worth putting in, starting just with the biology. Just the human body has a certain energy requirement, and you can measure it in energy over time and in power in watts, for example. And the human body requires about 100 watts to sustain itself.
That's in terms of food and
Just food, biological. So if we were just animals, that'd be our energy rate of usage. Now, if you look at as soon as mankind, as LaRouche has told the story many times, as soon as mankind started using controlled fire for cooking food, for changing the state of stones and rocks to shape them to make tools and various things, as soon as mankind began to apply a conscious scientific discovery with the use of fire to change his relationship to the universe, to the environment around him, then you could no longer measure mankind just as a biological species. And you have to measure what Mr. LaRouche has described as the energy flux density. So what's the energy flow per capita through the whole economy? And as Jason mentioned, if you take just the history of the United States, you get a very clear process of growth moving from a wood-based society to coal, to petroleum and natural gas. Now, at a wood-based society, the energy per capita is roughly about 30 times just your biological energy usage. So every one person is almost like 30 times more powerful by the application of technology.
And this isn't merely that you need 30 times more consumption. It's that that extra consumption capability enables you to produce more.
Right. So you can apply energy for production, for agriculture. You're applying more energy for your average person's activity day to day, which makes them more productive, more what Mr. LaRouche used to describe as the productive powers of labor. How productive is each person? How much can each person produce? Which is directly associated with this idea of energy flux density per capita.
And this in itself is just knowing this, what's in the chart, is a devastating critique of the idea of sustainability.
Right. Right, and so you get a clear idea of a measure of the physical process of human advance. What's the power per person, and how is that growing? And so with the movement from a wood-based society to coal, you had a roughly doubling of the power per capita of society, and it allowed us to transition to different resource bases, create totally new resources, and so you didn't, if you sustain yourself in any one level, you'd run the risk of running your resource base down.
And this also then increases one of the other categories that LaRouche has always used as a dynamic category of the economy, potential relative population density.
Yeah, exactly. Right, yeah. And so then if you look at the history of the United States, we hit 1970, and if we had maintained the growth and applied nuclear fission power, we would have roughly doubled the energy flux density since 1970 by about today. And we haven't done that. It went flat. And began to decline. So the actual power per person in the United States leveled off in 1970 and began to decline. So that's defined that gap. It's created a growth gap. There's a gap in where we should be relative to where we are. And that's defined in real physical terms the current economic breakdown.
And this has happened not just in the United States, but worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also most prominent in Europe, in Western Europe, where you also had a big orientation towards this green environmental zero growth policy.
Yeah, and Jason, you had brought up the problem of environmentalism. This chart that Ben is discussing, this trend, is directly not that we've run into the limits of scientific knowledge, but that we've actually put a cap on science, right?
Exactly. And it's a cap that could have been put on science at any point in the past. The concerns about the environment that were made at the late 60s, early 70s, when these things really began, in principle, are things that people could have complained about at any time in the past if they wished to stop progress. Usually in the past, it was done under different guises of saying that some countries just were meant to be poor and were meant to be slaves. That was, the British were a little bit more explicit about it back then. But take the introduction of the use of coal or oil, or even the use of wood. I mean, at a certain point in the U.S., our use of wood was at such an extent that we were simply going to use up our forests. For using wood for heating and for building of homes, we would run out of woods. And an environmentalist might have said, well, we better slow down and not, you know, we should start building grass huts or something. Instead,
or not have children.
Or not have children. And instead, when we have coal introduced, now wood, instead of being something that you just burn, you get to use its structure, which is something a lot more interesting about it than just the fact that it gets hot when you put it in a fire. Save it for houses. Right now, petroleum. Plastics are made from petroleum. A lot of people don't know that. So, you know, every time you're filling your car with gasoline and then just burning it, you figure this is actually useful stuff that we could have used, and instead we're just burning it up. And then nuclear, I mean, frankly, if the environmentalist movement was at all honest, they would have embraced nuclear technology with open arms. The use of nuclear power plants instead of coal, for example. Look, every year, 30,000 tons of radioactive uranium and thorium are introduced into the atmosphere by power plants in the world. Every year, 30,000 tons. None of that's from nuclear plants. That's all from coal plants. In burning coal, there's uranium and there's thorium in the coal. So if you want to reduce the amount of radiation...
You're not saying that's a health threat, though.
I'm not. I'm just saying to the extent you want to complain about people being exposed to radiation, every nuclear plant you build means people have less radiation they're exposed to. So the whole thing's ridiculous. You know, you look at the effort of the Manhattan Project to create an atomic bomb. The idea that all of that work and the difficulty of making that bomb is somehow going to happen by chance in a malfunctioning nuclear reactor is just completely preposterous. These plants, they're not going to blow up. They don't release radiation. They were attacked specifically for the same reason that Thomas Malthus said that poor people should be encouraged to live in slums with inadequate hygiene practices so that they will die, so that we won't have too many people. That's why nuclear power was attacked. Maybe some people, a lot of people got fooled into worrying about radiation, which you can't see it. It sounds scary, you know, but the push behind all of that wasn't to save people from something that was going to hurt them. It was to prevent human development and keep people poor.
And just to stay on this topic of the so-called greenies for a moment, you know, if you look at this trend line, you wonder, why is it that those people who are the proponents of nuclear power, the scientists and others, were so ineffective at making their case when this broad assault started with the Rachel Carson report, the limits to growth, and so on? I mean, do you have some thoughts on that, Ben? Because isn't this the problem today? If we're going to get this mission accomplished, we've got to get people who know something about this back into the forefront, and it looks to me like many of them are totally demoralized.
Yeah, well, it'll be a major fight. I mean, the media has been horrific on this stuff. I mean, take the whole Fukushima business. I mean, how many hours have been spent blabbing on the media about trying to just scare the crap out of the American people and the world about Fukushima? Well, the UN just came out with their official report on the radiation effects from Fukushima. And they said the sum total of people killed or harmed from radiation from the Fukushima event is zero. And they forecasted how many people they think are going to be harmed or killed by the radiation from the Fukushima event. And they said it's going to be a sum total of zero. So, you know, radiation in too much form is not good, but the proportion of scare tactics put on the population relative to the actuality of the situation has been absurd, and it's been absurd for a long time to create such a mass popular fear. And then, yeah, you have a major problem when scientists capitulate to that, when they think they have to go along with popular opinion. But I think now what Mr. LaRouche has really been emphasizing is we're reaching such a breaking point that we have a chance to shatter that popular opinion, that people are now faced with this gap in the growth of power per capita.
Well, this actually does become a threat to continued existence.
Right.
It's not just that we can show a trend line historically that there's been these leapfrogs to new platforms of development. It's when you don't have that, societies die.
Exactly, and that's what people are confronting right now. You know, Mr. LaRouche is pointing at food prices, basic prices of basic goods. Look at what's happened in the last 10 years even, in terms of just the cost for basic day-to-day survival. People are seeing a breakdown of the economy, and so we have to be up front and show this is the solution. The solution's not bailouts, it's not bail-in, it's not monetary. It's pushing towards a new physical economic platform that's going to increase the productivity of the whole society.
Well, let's get down to a couple basics here. And Jason, let me ask you, what is thermonuclear fusion? How does it work?
Well, Harley, the difference between fusion and fission is the difference between building something up and taking something apart. The fission, which was first used in the nuclear plants we have today and in the first atomic bombs, comes from breaking apart a heavy atom like uranium. And when you break it apart, energy is released. Fusion involves building up a larger atom from smaller ones. So this is the hypothesized cause of where the sun gets all of its energy from. The sun's still burning. You know, if the sun was made out of gasoline, it would have run out by now. Something else is happening there. So what we would do in a fusion power plant, or what occurs in the hydrogen bombs that have been developed, is that small atoms, basically isotopes of hydrogen, are combined together to make helium and some other products. In doing that, a tremendous amount of energy is created, following Einstein's famous formulation, which is sort of the shorthand for Einstein, but maybe people don't know what it means, that E equals mc squared. C is the speed of light. That's very fast. Square it. That's an enormous number. That's the amount of energy in every bit of m, in every bit of mass, that disappears in a fusion reaction. When you put together deuterium and tritium, two isotopes of hydrogen, and you create helium and a neutron, the resulting helium and a neutron weigh less than the initial deuterium and tritium. Where did that extra mass disappear to? It turned into the energy released in the fusion process. So it's a very, very efficient potential means of creating energy, and beyond the uses of electricity that we would expect today to be able to replace, an old coal plant with a fusion plant, it also, because it's very hot and because it's creating these neutrons, could be used for other applications as well.
Well, now, given that we know that this works because we did have successful thermonuclear weapons, what's the problem in bringing thermonuclear fusion online as an energy source? Ben, why don't you?
Well, there's a few variations on methods for doing it. One of the main, probably better known, is what you call magnetic confinement. So the thing with these isotopes of hydrogen that Jason's talking about, if you get it to a high enough temperature, it becomes a plasma. It's ionized. It's called so the each atom loses its electrons, so it begins to have a charge. So because it has a charge, then each atom can be controlled by a magnetic field. So you can contain this plasma in a magnetic field. One of the more common designs is like a donut shape, a tokamak design,
yeah.
And so you can keep it away from the walls with the magnetic field, and you can get this plasma incredibly hot by heating it with various types of beams and radio waves and different things. And you can get it to such high temperatures that the basic description that's used is the atoms are moving so fast, and you get it a high enough density, there's enough of them, they start running into each other and fusing, the way Jason described, where two atoms will collide.
And then they release the energy.
Right.
How do you direct the energy that's released then so that you can use it?
Well, and then there's, again, various descriptions of how to do it. A first stage generation system could just be using the heat generated from the process to boil steam to spin a turbine. That could be a first generation application of fusion power.
But you can use it directly then, also use the plasma directly.
And then more advanced techniques, yeah, would be using the, if you have more advanced fuels, you could do what you call direct conversion, where you basically use the plasma itself, moving the plasma quickly through a magnetic field to induce an electrical current, and then you can get a higher level of efficiency. But I think just to put one thing you mentioned at the very beginning, I think it's important just to dispel some myths on fusion, mm-hmm. because the constant line is it's 30 years away.
Right.
And the bad joke is that it's always 30 years away,
whenever
you ask that question.
I was just going to bring up that in this report, we have a list of the various programs, and many of them seem very close to or even have already achieved so-called break-even.
Mm-hmm. And the reactors that have been built have come close, and scientists since the 1970s have said, okay, we generally know what type of reactor would take us to the next step. And they were designed it, and they were never given the money to build it. So, for example, the big flagship tokamak reactor right now is called ITER. It's this huge international project. It's been known since the 1970s and 80s that this would be the next step towards building an actual fusion reactor. So the general rough concept was already there in the 1970s. The designs were being done in the 1980s. If we had had a serious commitment from the government, it could have been built by 1990.
Well, some of us remember people like myself who were part of the founding of the fusion energy in the 70s. Remember a bill that was passed through the Congress, the McCormick Fusion Bill, which did say that we're going to have the funding of these various studies that would then move into a stage of implementation. But that never took place.
That's exactly it. Yeah, right. So the ITER would have been approximates one of the two stages proposed in that bill, done by around 1990, and then a demonstration power reactor by around 2000. So the point is, the bill was passed, and the funding was just never given. So anybody who says that, it's basically the equivalent of a contract with some guy to build a bridge. Say, I want you to build this bridge. Say, okay, it'll cost you $100,000, and I can do it. And then you give the guy $1,000 a year. And then you come to him in 10 years and say, where's my bridge?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just absurd. There's not to say it's always 30 years away and we haven't figured out the science yet. It's just either ignorance of the matter, which is unfortunately common, or certain people that are intentionally lying to spread false ideas and pessimism around fusion power. It's been a political decision not to build the reactors, not to continue with the tests, not to make the level of investment that was known from day one would be required to do it. They knew in the McCormick bill, earlier studies in the 70s, they knew what level of investment would be needed. And they said very clearly, we need this certain level of investment, and they didn't get that level of investment. So there's no surprise that we're 40 years behind now because they were not given what they need to do the program.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is September 28th, 2013. And we're talking with Jason Ross and Ben Denniston, who are two of the principal authors of this report, which is available on the 21st Century website. And is it still available on LaRouche Pack? Yeah. Excuse me. So you can still get it on the LaRouche Pack website. And it does give you what you need to know to organize. Now, Jason, in the discussion today with Mr. LaRouche, he did make the point that even though we can say we don't have to wait 30 years, it still will take a decade or so before you could get to a successful commercial fusion program. Is that essentially your understanding?
Well, yeah, the programs do take some time once you decide. Because the engineering and then the construction of these things it can be time consuming.
Well, but there is an interim program that we lay out in the pamphlet.
Yes, there is. I can't resist. I just want to go back to, you said, well, we made a bomb. What are the added difficulties in having a more controlled fusion? I was thinking, you know, having a wood-burning stove, or even if you can build a cannon much more easily than you can build a car engine. So using the power of combustion to knock a cannonball, that's one thing. Making it happen 50 times a second in your automobile in a perfect way is very difficult.
That's why we have engineers.
That's right. That's right. And that's why, you know, it takes
And it's
some
a
work.
Noble profession.
In terms of interim projects that we can do to start realizing the benefits of the breakthroughs we've already made, namely nuclear fission, some of the biggest applications of that would be possible sooner than it would take to get fusion online would be, for example, the use of desalination, of water desalination. And there's a big discussion of that in the NOAAPA 21 special report, that there are sites around the country. We put forward about 42 sites, either coastal areas that could use seawater desalinated for metropolitan water needs, and then also inland areas where there are salinity problems for various reasons, or agricultural wastewater, which could be cleaned up and reused. And those are
things. And these should be done with existing or upgraded fission, nuclear fission.
Yeah, these are things that, in other words, with fusion, we don't really know what we're going to be building in the end. We still do need to do the experiments to get there. We know which experiments we want to build. We know that. We don't have what we know would be a working design for a commercial fusion plant yet. For water desalination, we know how to do that. We could build these things. Now, that would require an engineering and industrial buildup again, but we could have these things built within 5 years if we really decided to do it.
And we need the water for the whole part of the country, which is lacking the water right
Absolutely.
Now.
This is another thing that you can perhaps ignore if you're not a farmer, if you don't see it. If you don't see the dropping of the Ogallala Aquifer, if you don't see or hear about, which many people increasingly are, the fights around water rights around the Colorado River, for example. So if you think about it, how would we help agriculture? How would we help people in the inner parts of California by building desalination plants near San Diego or Los Angeles, for example? Well, the answer is simple. Every bit of water that you provide to Los Angeles or San Diego by desalination is that much less water that they have to take from more inland parts of the state. So you are indirectly able to bring water inland to provide stability for these agricultural regions by providing coastal desalination. So the full NOAAPA, the full North American Water and Power Alliance concept, that is going to take a decade or two, before we see the result of that in a dramatically increased water distribution in the Southwest. But desalination would let us begin to see some of these effects for adding the agriculture in the inland parts by reducing the water needs along the coast.
Well, I think one of the most important things that comes through in this report is that we're dealing with a political problem. We're not dealing with a science problem. The science is there. We can forecast with some certainty what direction we have to go to do this. But Ben, I want you to take up something that I've had a couple of people sort of wrinkle their foreheads, or one person almost fell off his chair when I said that, look, if you really want to make NOAAPA work, it has to be thermonuclear. And he just said, you'll never sell it. You'll never sell it. Why are we going with a thermonuclear NOAAPA instead of the original design with hydropower and things of that sort?
Well, it goes to the whole, I mean, there's various aspects. And the fundamental thing, I think, that Mr. Lew started to really push to drive the NOAAPA program to a higher level is this, go back to this energy flux density conception, that the fundamental character of mankind's progress can be measured in the energy flux density per capita. So how can we increase the energy flux density of the entire economy? And as we're discussing, we've been sitting on fusion as the next step for years. And the thing is that these past 3-4 decades of non-growth haven't just been a pause. It's not just stagnant. It's a decline. We're running down our previous resource bases. We're running down our infrastructure. We're running down our economy overall by not progressing. So we've built into the current system a deep collapse by refusing to progress and by sticking with older technologies and not making the upgrades and investments in the infrastructure, in the industry base, in agriculture. So the way to overcome the 4 decades of attrition, it has to be pushing to a higher frontier, a higher level of energy flux density per capita. And that's where thermonuclear fusion comes in.
Do we reach a point where the attrition makes it impossible to make the leap? Is that one of the things that we're looking at, that because you're using existing resources and scaling back, that the idea of subsistence or the environmentalist idea of lowering the use of energy, that you get to, or even the loss of skilled labor and skilled technology. Do we get to the point where we can't make it to the next phase?
Yes, and we're facing that right now. I mean, these aren't decisions that can wait forever. If you talk to people in the engineering field, they'll tell you a couple of things. One is that younger workers have a tremendous difficulty having the attention span to be able to do the kind of detailed work that we need in modern manufacturing jobs. The other thing they'll tell you is that the engineers are also similarly very hard to find. That for senior project engineers who've got a lot of experience, there are harder and harder to get a hold of for job positions, that they're unable to fill these kinds of things. We've got a lot of people who knew about these programs back when we did have the Plowshare program, back when we were doing real work on this nuclear topic. These men are getting old. Many of them are dead already. So yes, you run into a real problem where it becomes difficult physically based on the resources and based on the human resources as well. But we, in terms of getting in that direction, that's why we also see the real war threat right now. You know, the difficulties, the push for war is another way of moving on this front, as a way of controlling the thing. Also, let me just say something about what you had brought up earlier about the person you're talking to falling out of the chair about, can't we just build the normal NOAAPA? Because I had a similar response in a recent meeting. And look, the point is, there's no way, if we've got a society that's willing to overthrow their cult-like environmentalist belief that people should never do anything that changes nature, if they can get over that enough to reroute 20% of water from major rivers and dramatically transform the environment of North America, if they make that breakthrough, they'll be able to get over their irrational fear of nuclear power. You know, when you grow up, you get rid of a lot of fears, including the boogeyman in the closet, among others. There's no legitimate reason to have these fears. Most people don't have them in any deep-seated way. It's something you require socially. Everybody seems to think this. I see on the TV that something terrible's happening at Fukushima. So sometimes even going through the specifics of, you know, how nuclear power works won't get through to some people if their real reason for the fear is just that everybody seems to think it. So these are the sort of things you can get past. I mean, if we had Franklin Roosevelt give some fireside chats about the atomic nucleus and the NOAAPA, people would be, we'd be able to do it.
Well, you know, I think this is actually the challenge for our organization right now, and that's why Lynn keeps talking about this question of forecasting and the imagination. Because right now, I think most people expect that everything's going to keep getting worse. And they just think, is there some way for me to carve out a little piece of security, maybe keep a few extra pieces of gold or 4 tons of beef jerky in the basement or, you know, something like that. And I think this is why I like so much that we have written this report from the very beginning. We talk about essentially the Promethean quality of man, that what you see is that getting fire from the gods is that which differentiates us. And I think we almost have to, we can't do this without firing the imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think the other guiding post that I think helped the whole thing was Mr. LaRouche talking about this century perspective, thinking about the whole next century as a unit and dividing the next century into 4 generations and thinking about where are we going to be in each of those 4 generations. And I think, you know, there's a certain amount of real profound immorality in this individual, I'm just going to get my beef jerky and gold and try and hide away. I mean, we need to revive as much as anything a sense of responsibility for future generations. If we can't tap into that in the American people and revive within them a commitment and a sense to saying my life only has a purpose for ensuring that the next generation has a better existence, has a better economy, has more opportunities to develop scientifically, culturally. If that's not the guiding principle within society, again, you're not going to have any solutions to any of this. There's a kind of invariant we need to. And that's also where the green ideology has been a major moral corruption. So it is a whole, I think, single shift we're talking about. And really, and again, it's not something new we're creating. This has been the history of the United States, is this concept of progress, that mankind is a Promethean species, that mankind has a creative spark, that all men are created equal with this creative spark, and that the reason you have governments and money and an economy and a credit system is to facilitate each generation developing to a higher level than the previous one.
Well, it's no coincidence that this stagnation in science and in economic development is running parallel with the collapse of morality and the retreat into me, me, me. Because you really, I think back to my parents, my grandparents, the previous generations, who always had the sense that there will be a better future. And better just didn't mean more choices of flavored potato chips, mm-hmm. But the idea that you can learn more and apply it and make new discoveries, and that in fact is what education is about. And that's what's been lost in this. And I know, Jason, you wanted to say some things about environmentalism, because this is something that is really at the heart of this. And as long as we tolerate greenies and environmentalists, there will be no progress.
Yeah, and the name really oughtn't to be environmentalist most of the time. It should be called anti-humanist, using our surroundings as an excuse for killing people in a way that the British East India Company would have done on racial grounds. Because look, take a look at carbon, for example. We're going to have worldwide carbon trading, supposedly. We've got to stop this global warming that isn't even happening. It's getting colder. But what is going to be the target of this? Mostly poorer people and poorer countries. The British a couple centuries ago would have simply said that the darker races are stupid, that they're fundamentally different than the wonderful British, who are just the best around. And they'd say, for this reason, these people are naturally backwards and they exist to be our slaves. Now, you're not really going to say that quite so explicitly anymore. Instead, you prevent development by other means. Take, for example, there's no real difference between this environmentalist outlook and the way that Russia and China are being approached. If you see the growth of Russia and China as a threat to your ability to be superior, then you're replacing the natural human power over nature with a, frankly, neurotic desire for power over other human beings, like the child who gets to bully other people around. That's not an adult outlook for a human being generally, and certainly not for a nation state to have. So are we going to be destroying or are we going to be building? Take a lot of what the left turned into, where instead of the left being about helping the working man, about helping people live better lives, etc., it became the idea that people are pollution. Now, how are you going to help ennoble people who have been disadvantaged in society for various reasons if you think, frankly, they should just be dead anyway? You're not going to. So what are we going to do? Are we going to destroy the structures of power? Are we going to, try to attack this and attack that? What are we going to build? It got attacked. The idea that it's an old-fashioned thing to think about, putting your nose to the grindstone and building something for the next generations. That's just a natural human thing to do. If we don't do that, we're not going to exist.
Well, but then if you take a look at how this paradigm shift occurred, one of the things that we can look to in terms of our own organization is the Nuclear Club of Wall Street. The fact that you actually had corporate networks that organized to suppress these technologies, and part of what they did was attack Lyndon LaRouche and the Fusion Energy Foundation. Mm-hmm. I think we've dug up some of these materials in the last couple of days, and it's clear that when we say it's natural to develop, in fact, the unnatural is what has been funded to make sure that doesn't work.
Yeah. Anyway, I think the fundamental, it's a question of empire, and for empire to exist, it requires this bestialization of the population. You said, I think you have to have both. Yeah, I think you had to have the cultural, moral collapse to get this economic collapse. I mean, it's a whole other subject, but that was a huge part of the shift around Kennedy's assassination, was this whole cultural shift towards drugs, sex, immediate pleasure,
and pessimism about the future,
because it's a idea of man as a beast, but that is the idea that the empire requires for it to exist. I mean, if you look at Adam Smith in his central principles of economics, it's that he states explicitly that mankind should have no conscious sense of what his senses and desires will lead to, but just follow them. Just follow your desires, follow your pleasures, avoid pain, pursue pleasure, and good things will come about. What's that mean? It means there's no future in your mind. You have no concept of the future. You have no concept of creating a future. And that's the ideology of mankind as a beast that the empire requires for it to exist.
And I think it's important, in the introduction to this pamphlet, and again, I'm talking about the Nuclear Nawapa 21, Gateway to the Fusion Economy, and you can get this through 21st Century Science and Technology. The opening sentence is, "This planet can no longer tolerate environmentalists." And I think that's a useful starting point. Now, let's get to this question then of how are we going to organize people to support this? Because I think people know there's a crisis. This is now, it's now acceptable to say that Obama's a failed president. It's now clear that we're continuing to bail out the too-big-to-fail banks at the expense of the economy. There are a lot of people who are angry about this, especially now we're coming up with the whole confetti and smoke and mirrors around the debt ceiling fight to disorient people. You've got the Obamacare that starts in a couple of days, so you can choose which policy you can't afford that will deny you medical care. And people are really in an agitated state. How do we move them? I'm asking both of you to respond to this. Your way of thinking about how to organize the average person to grasp something as big as what we're talking about, the whole history of humanity as a process of development, versus an empire that's trying to convince you, your little ant, that they can crush at any point. How do we get that across to people? Let me start with you, Jason.
I think we have to do it by putting the whole thing forward as one concept. And that's very key. That if we try to approach organizing people as one project at a time, we need Nawapa, or we need to have fusion power, your power bill, you know, your electricity bill won't be so high, and you can, you know, then you can catch up on your rent you're behind on. Forget it. That's why the pamphlet does begin with this. The planet cannot tolerate environmentalists. We've got an ideology that affects all of us to some degree or another because it's been consciously promoted, that's anti-human, that says that people are bad and that says that development is a bad thing. This is just another form of empire. It's not anything different than that. It's its latest guise. And in liberating people from this burdensome notion that they're a plague on the earth, maybe not everybody is, you know, affected by this to the same degree.
See, I don't think most people – there's a funny thing about this. I was doing a class one time and a person said, well, you're just wrong because you're too idealistic. All human beings are evil. That's what it says in the Bible. And so I turned to the guy and I said, is that your wife next to you? And he said, yes. And I said, is she evil? And he shrank to about 2 inches tall and he realized he was being a fool. But that's the problem you have, because most people will say things that they don't believe, but they'll follow that path in the way they live.
No, people have philosophies, whether they're aware of them or not, which is what makes them very dangerous when people are unaware of them. But if you think about how people are different in a different context, like let's just go back to the space program, which is another great example of something that was just killed off to kill it off to prevent optimism, not because it was a bad investment or anything of the sort. It was just killed off for political reasons. In that context, people are growing up, kids are growing up, they're thinking about being an astronaut. We're producing engineers at rates that had not been equaled since.
Now about the 60s.
Yeah, 60s during the Apollo program. So we had a whole era where everybody's concept of themselves was a very different one. Of, wow, what can we do? Look, we're going to be able to do this. This is where we're going. And it's a lot different now because obviously we don't have that coming from the White House. We don't have John F. Kennedy in the White House anymore. You know, we've got Obama in the White House. You know, it's sort of an empty house at this point. So it's a lot different to put people in the position of themselves having to understand this and be the leaders. But that is an important thing that we have to get people to do. Not to support a project that someone else is going to push for, but that they themselves have to develop to a good degree this concept of where we need to go in the future. That between fusion and Nawapa, that the water crisis that means you will not eat. I mean, look, people are going to starve to death in the U.S. Let's say that we put everything else on hold by some magical spell or something like this. We just go forward 30 years. Where's the water? Where's the food? There isn't any. You're going to starve to death. Are we just going to let that one sit around? Well, we address that water crisis with the Nawapa. We develop an independence from worrying about whether this is a year of plenty rain or too little rain, a flood, a drought. We develop an independence from our surroundings. That's what the human species does. We're not wandering around the woods hoping we find nuts and berries or, you know, some fish to catch. we are able to create our own environment and our own ability to survive. So with Nawapa, we don't have to worry about these water problems. With the development of fusion, the idea of worrying about energy will be a thing of the past. You know, the fears about foreign control of oil. You know, I read a book recently that said that with a fusion economy, OPEC's control over petroleum will be about as advantageous to them as their current control of camel milk supplies on the planet is. It won't really matter. So, you know, we change the whole game with this. And I think if we liberate people to realize, hey, this is where we should have been, there's no, you know, physical reason that this didn't happen. These aren't impossible goals to achieve. They've been prevented by people putting on themselves chains dictated to them by an oligarchy that is preventing these projects.
Well, when you talk about change in thinking, I think we've seen some of that also around the whole build-up to the Syrian war, where people who previously didn't like the Russians, they were distrustful of Putin, they called Putin a thug. Some people thought that if we build the Bering Strait tunnel, it'll be easier for the Russians or the Chinese to attack us, you know, by going through the tunnel. But I think all of a sudden people are looking at Russia differently. And one of the key components of what Mr. LaRouche has put forward is this is not just for the United States. It wouldn't work just for the United States. And Ben, I'd like you to talk a little bit about this whole idea of taking the Trans-Pacific away from Obama's free trade and air-sea battle war against China to the idea of this Westphalian principle of cooperation for the benefit of the other.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, but the point is we have a potential alliance that can shape history into the future. You have factions in China that want to progress, they want to grow, and there's a lot that can be said, but just take, for example, the Copenhagen summit in 2009. China and other nations said no to the British Empire. They said no to this carbon capping policy. They said no to this green garbage, and they said, we need to grow. We need to develop. They're the ones pushing towards thermonuclear fusion. You have other nations, South Korea, Japan, Russia. All these nations have factions that want to progress, which we haven't had for these 40 years. So if the United States says we want to join an alliance with these other nations, you know, and nobody's talking about a perfect, flowery world where everything's going to be perfect instantly, but you have the conditions which haven't really you've never had a world where the most powerful nations for a prolonged period of time were locked into a committed agreement for the benefit of the other, for the progress of all nations involved.
Well, and we've just seen in the last couple of days the openings with Iran, the potential for that, the move away from a confrontation with Syria, directly in collaboration with the Russians. And if you go back to what we were talking about, that this is the, if you look at the early 60s in John Kennedy, he became clear that we now possess the capability to destroy each other, destroy the whole planet with weapons. Can we do something different? But that still runs up against this kind of rugged individualism, we can make it on our own. But I think this is one of the things that we're going to have to break through on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's going to be, with the United States, China, and Russia, that's a global revolution. And if it's centered around thermonuclear power, it's centered around developing the Arctic, which is a huge resource base for the world, huge potential up there.
Now, when you say that, what's in the Arctic or in Siberia that's particularly useful?
Whole variety of ranges of resources, metals, rare earth metals. Obviously, the big focus now is the oil and natural gas, which, as Jason discussed, can be used for other things than burning, but it can be useful for other purposes for the petrochemical industry. So a lot of the basic metals and other resources needed are available in abundance in deposits that have been mapped out and identified up in this region. And so it's a region waiting to be developed, and it's a challenge. And Mr. LaRouche address this in a very good way in a webcast a week before Friday, where he was talking about peace. He was asked a question about Iran's moves towards peace, and he said you have to have a positive basis for peace. You have to have a positive challenge. It's not just saying we're going to agree not to shoot each other. It's saying we're all humans on this planet, and we are, as all humans, we're facing certain challenges. to lift the world out of poverty and deal with power and resource shortages, that's a common challenge. The Earth is a small part of the whole solar system. I'm not sure if people have realized that there's a big solar system out there with a lot of objects. We don't know. There's millions. This thing that hit over Russia the other year is a tiny object compared to what's out there. And there's millions of those out there. And we don't know. We know probably less than 1% of that total population, where it is at any one given time. So at this point, the most likely thing is that we'll get hit again with maybe a couple days warning with another asteroid without even knowing it was coming. So there's much bigger issues that mankind as a whole has to face. So the question I see it is, can we get nations to come to agreements, long-term agreements on how to address those challenges and let that become the basis, a new basis for international relations?
We also have in the NWAPA 21 report a section on the relationship between the thermonuclear NWAPA and space exploration. And Jason, I'd like you to just say a couple words on that.
Well, the other, because that's one thing that's not very explicitly addressed in great detail in this report, but it's the obvious other main goal that will pull together so many of the scientific challenges and breakthroughs that we're able to make right now that are waiting to get made. So if you think about fusion, we've got, as you know, as we've been discussing, the different types of fusion research that are being proposed on the Earth. Another major aspect of this is fusion in space. Now, if we started with the goal of trying to build a fusion-powered engine for travel to Mars, to be able to get out to an asteroid quickly, to move it out of the way, etc., that would bring in another dimension to possible designs that we couldn't even consider here on the Earth. But there are so many things to figure out in space, both the actual science of it, as you know, as Curiosity is doing on Mars, just as one example, and then overcoming the challenges to being able to place the objects out there that we'd like to move people where we'd like to. As we saw in the Apollo program, figuring out how to get to the moon. And people say, well, we spent a lot of money going to the moon. Well, we didn't spend the money on the moon. You know, the astronauts didn't go up there and leave a bunch of, you know, suitcases full of cash on the moon. We spent all the money here on Earth. And in doing so, generated spin-offs in other areas that, I mean, we actually were working directly on making new technologies. So that's the other major aspect that'll really pull this all together and achieve some solid gains that'll have major impacts on the way we run industry and everything else.
Well, to come back to where we started, the idea of a mission, one of the things that struck me from the discussion with Mr. LaRouche this morning is this idea that how do you get the changes in the practical implementation policy? You can't get them by arguing over them. For example, you're never going to get Glass-Steagall by arguing whether a banking separation is better than bailouts. I mean, it's obvious that it is, but there are people who have other reasons for supporting it. But if people actually get a sense that our real mission, our higher mission, is this idea of a fusion economy, then it's clear we've got to change the way we do our banking and credit system. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way we can inspire people and move them. And I'd like your thoughts on that, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to pick up off what Jason was saying, I mean, to handle the solar system requires a fusion economy. It's just flat the reality of the thing. If mankind is, and I think that's a pretty good and profound expression of mankind as a Promethean species. No other animal species can defend the planet.
Or has a space program,
right? Where was the dinosaur space program? Maybe they'd be a little bit better off if they had one. They didn't.
Well, I think we did send a couple dogs into space.
So. Yeah. So the point is the only mankind acting in this creative fashion can defend the entire Earth. We know there's going to be impacts again in the future. We know that's going to happen. It's just a question of when. We're just gambling with the future right now. There is no defense right now of the planet. If we saw one of these things coming, we would likely not be able to do anything. There's certain very limited scenarios where we could do certain things, but for most scenarios, right now, we have no defense whatsoever.
It would probably even be impossible to move people out of the area. If you look at what happened in Siberia, it was there before they knew it was there.
Yeah, right. Or even if we had more warning time, look at, you know, Katrina. And I mean, our infrastructure is terrible for even moving people. So, I mean, but it just...
Look at a morning commute.
Yeah, right. So it's an expression of what that only with a thermonuclear platform can we even begin to handle these types of challenges. And that's, I think, a good expression of what we could call the adulthood of humanity, the growing up of humanity, having a society that's actually consciously really built around an understanding of what mankind is. Mankind is a certain creative species. Right now, international relations, the actions of nations very, very rarely reflect that in any type of serious way. Our economic policy does not reflect that in a serious way. Mankind is waiting still to be on a state where our economic policy, our relations among nations, our action as a whole is actually coherent and governed by a scientific understanding of what mankind really is in this universe.
And since that's lacking among virtually anybody in the Congress, it's certainly not there in the White House. Jason, where does the leadership come from to do this?
Well, that's kind of that's the good question. That involves people that we're going to have to find as well, and then people who might not even be expecting it. But that's really what we do with our organizing all the time, on all fronts. I mean, we find people in the general population who surprise themselves by what they do. We find people in Congress who might still be surprised with what we've gotten them to do. We find people in state legislatures that have been surprised. We find scientists. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that this is going to change every aspect of life. You know, when Ben was talking about the need for the space program and fusion, I was picturing perhaps some listeners thinking, well, yeah, but I'm not going to space, or that just seems like it's some faraway thing that some scientists are going to do, and then I won't have to worry about an asteroid hitting me. But
I wasn't worried about anyway.
Which you probably weren't worried about anyway, because you figure, whatever, if we're all going, we're all going, if it's that time. But this is something that's going to change every aspect of your life, including, you know, and a really big one would be education, for example. Because people who see what's going on with kids in school, I mean, it's terrifying when you see what's being done to these children. When you see how they're being taught or not taught to be, you know, it's hardly as if they have teachers with these curricula that are being developed nationwide with these multiple choice tests and everything else. It's more like you've got a prison wardens with some inmates than teachers who are able to actually develop ways of reaching children. And so just going back to what happened in the 60s with the Apollo program, how will our view of children in school be different if we need people? I mean, right now, almost everybody's got negative economic value. Under a monetarist system right now, people have negative value. People being alive is negative. This is why you end up seeing, okay, we're going to cut health care. This is why we're going to cut this. We're going to cut that, because people have a negative value. The context changes when we're going this direction. Everything about your life changes. Everything about the value of your life changes. And then just physically, your life, I mean, this is going to be, anyway, it's hard to even kind of describe or even try to imagine how things would be different.
But it is something that people have to really work on and read and think and engage in discussions, because, as we were saying, the leadership is going to come from people who right now might not see themselves as leaders.
Yes, but the ability to understand this, it's all there. You know, we've got this report, we've got videos coming out, we've got more things to follow up on this, so we're developing working hard on developing a more thorough and full ability to deliver this concept to people so they can organize others as well. Because this isn't going to come from, we don't have John Kennedy. This isn't going to come from the White House. We have to have, I mean, we're a republic. To function, we do require a certain level of intelligence and concern and morality on the part of our citizenry. Without that, you can't survive as a republic.
And the crisis is definitely here. Ben, we have a little more than a minute. Turn it over to you to what you have to communicate to the people out there.
I mean, just to pick up off that, I mean, I think also the other idea is people tend to have a pretty bad idea of what leadership or authority is. It's not about how much you know, how many facts you know. The big thing is popular opinion. It's not about what other people see you as. Any real authority comes from this insight into the future. That's how Mr. LaRouche built this movement. That's how Mr. LaRouche was able to do everything he's done, not by getting popular opinion, not by knowing all the facts, not by getting what people tend to think is popular support or popular conceptions of leadership or authority. He derives his authority from an insight into the future. He knows where mankind should go, what's going to happen if we don't take that path, And he's able to wield that authority in building this movement and intervening politically in the United States and internationally. And any individual who's serious can wield that authority. You can wield the authority of the future. You can express the reality of the future as being more real than your popular opinion experience, your cultural day-to-day experience. You can communicate, and that's what people, I think, really move when they get a sense of that. When they get a sense that you're expressing a higher truth, a lot of times it's not in the facts you communicate, but people resonate with a sense that this person is serious.
And there's a hunger right now for solutions and a hunger to actually know something, to overcome the terrible uncertainty. We have run out of time. I'm very happy that we had this chance to have this discussion. Remember, Nuclear Nawapa 21, however you get your hands on it, you've got to get it. And it's available through 21st Century, through LaRouche Pack, LaRouche Pub. Call your local LaRouche organizer. Get it and read it and organize around it. So this has been the LaRouche Show for today. We'll be back next Saturday with another edition of the LaRouche Show at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you, Ben and Jason.
Thanks.